use a spermicide on April 1st. Would that not be your expert opinion? Does it not seem to you, sir, as an expert and a scientist, the most obvious reason that no trace of a spermicide could be found in her apartment? Kumagai seems to sigh. I cannot answer your questions, sir, he says with some dignity. Well, answer this question, Dr. Kumagai. Is it not clear, given these facts, that the specimen you sent to the chemist was not taken from the body of Carolyn Polhemus? Kumagai now sits back. He pushes his glasses back up on his nose. I have a regular procedure. Are you telling this jury, sir, that you have a clear recollection of taking that specimen, marking it, sending it on? No. I repeat, is it not likely that the specimen containing the spermicide, the specimen identified as containing fluids of Mr. Savage's blood type, was not taken from the body of Carolyn Polhemus? Painless shakes his head again. But this is not denial. He does not know what occurred. Sir, is it not likely? It is possible, he finally says. From the jury box, clear across the courtroom, I can hear one of the men say, For Christ's sake. And that specimen, Dr. Kumagai, was sent, was it not, while you were having these regular conversations with Mr. Molto. Am I right? With this, Kumagai finally rediscovers his spark. He draws himself up in the chair. Do you accuse me, Mr. Stern? It is some time before Stern speaks. We have had enough unsupported accusations for one case, he says. Then, before resuming his chair, Stern nods in the direction of the witness as if to dismiss him. Dr. Kumagai, he adds. After court, Jamie Kemp and I sit in Stern's conference room describing Kumagai's cross-examination for a small audience, composed of Sandy's secretary, the private investigator Berman, and two law students who work in the office as clerks. Kemp has brought out a bottle of champagne, and one of the young people has turned on a radio. A fine actor, Kemp does a burlesque in which he plays the parts of both Stern and Kumagai. He repeats Stern's most damaging questions in an insistent tone, and then falls in a chair where he beats his feet and makes the sounds of a person being choked. We are roaring when Stern comes through the door. He has on a tuxedo, or more properly, part of it. Only the striped trousers and the boiled shirt. A red bow tie, not yet knotted, is through his collar. Inspecting the scene, he is livid. A fierce anger grips all his features. You can tell that he is struggling to keep himself in check. This is inappropriate, he says. He is speaking to Kemp. Entirely inappropriate. We are on trial. This is not the time to congratulate ourselves. We may not bring a trace of smugness to that courtroom. Juries sense such things intuitively, and they resent it. Now, if you would please clean this up, I wish to speak with my client. Rusty, he says. When you have a moment. He wheels and I follow Stern to his office with its soft, almost feminine interior. I suspect that Clara had a hand in the decoration. Everything is done in the same creamy tone. Full-length drapes cover the windows, and furnishings upholstered in Haitian cotton crowd the office, so that it feels as if you are being pushed into a seat. Stern has a heavy crystal ashtray at each corner of his desk. It's my fault more than Jamie's, I say when I enter. Thank you, but you are not charged with making judgments at this time. He is. That was entirely inappropriate. It was a great triumph. He's worked hard. We were enjoying it. He was trying to put your client at ease. You need not defend Kemp to me. He is a first-rate attorney, and I value his work. Perhaps I am to blame. As a case is headed toward conclusion, I always become tense. You should savor today, Sandy. No lawyer gets many crosses like that, especially of the state's expert.
That is so, says Stern, and he indulges in a brief whimsical smile. What a colossal blunder.
He makes a sound, a groan of sorts, and shakes his head.
But that is past now. You have been very insistent, and so I wanted to take one moment with you to discuss the case for the defense.
I wish there were more time, but I have committed myself months ago to this dinner for Judge Magnuson. Delaguardia will be there, so we will all be evenly disadvantaged. He smiles in appreciation of his own understated humor.
At any rate, your defense. Decisions on these matters are always the client's. If you wish, I will give you my advice. If not, feel free to dictate. I am at your disposal.
As I anticipated all along, Sandy has waited until we are clearly ahead on points before allowing me to make my decisions. I know what he would suggest.
You think we'll even get the chance to offer a defense?
You mean, do I think Judge Little will direct a verdict for us tomorrow?
In your view, is that possible?
I would be surprised. He takes up his cigar from the ashtray. Realistically, my answer is no.
What's left that ties me to the crime?
Rusty, there is no need for me to lecture you, but you must remember that the inferences at this stage must be taken in the light most favorable to the prosecution. Even Kumagai's direct testimony, preposterous as it now seems, must be credited for purposes of the motion. And the answer to your question is that the evidence, in any light, ties you to the scene. Your fingerprints are there. Carpeting, which could be yours, is there. The phone records show you were in contact. And all of this was concealed.
On a more practical level, no judge is eager to usurp the jury's role as decision-maker in a case of this stature. He invites criticism, and perhaps more importantly, he leaves a sense abroad that the case was never fairly resolved. I regard the prosecution evidence, as it stands, as paper-thin. It is likely that the judge sees it the same way, but he would no doubt prefer to have the jury discharge you. If, unaccountably, they fail in that responsibility, he can grant a motion for acquittal post-trial, notwithstanding the verdict. I would consider that far more likely in this case.
He makes sense, but I was hoping he would say something else.
So that brings us to the question of a defense, Stern says. Certainly, if we proceed, we must offer certain documents. We want to establish that Barbara was at the U, as you claimed. So we will present the computer log to demonstrate she signed on shortly after 8 o'clock. We want to show that the rent-a-car and taxi companies have no records to support the notion that you traveled to the city on the night of April 1st. The gynecologist's records we spoke of today must, of course, be offered. Other odds and ends. I take all of that as given. Whether we bring on testimony is the question.
Who would you consider calling?
Character witnesses? Certainly Barbara.
I don't want her to testify, I say at once.
She is an attractive woman, Rusty, and there are 5 men on the jury. She can support your alibi quite effectively.
No doubt she is willing.
If I testify, and she's sitting in the first row smiling at me, the jury will know that she supports my alibi. There's no need for her to get chewed up.
Stern makes a sound. I have disrupted his plans.
You don't want me to get up there, do you, Sandy?
He does not answer at first. Instead, he brushes a trace of cigar ash from the pleats on his shirt.
Are you reluctant because of my relationship with Carolyn? I ask. I won't deny it, you know.
I know that, Rusty, and I do not find that encouraging. I think it would give a large boost to the state, which they desperately need.
Frankly, we run some risk that the same facts might also emerge on Barbara's cross-examination.
The confidential communications privilege would probably prohibit inquiry into your admissions to your wife about your affair, but one can never be certain.
Overall, it is probably not worth the chance. Stern seems casual in admitting that I was right after all. It really does not make much sense to talk about calling Barbara. But disclosure of these matters is not my principal concern about your testimony, Sandy says, getting to his feet. He feigns stretching, but I know by now that he wants to come sit beside me on the couch, the place where he delivers all the bad news. He adjusts a picture of Clara and the children on the white birch credenza behind his desk, then, most naturally, settles next to me.
Rusty, I prefer to see the defendant take the stand. No matter how often and how insistently jurors are told that they must not hold a defendant's silence against him, it is an impossible instruction to follow. A jury wants to hear a denial, particularly when the defendant is a person accustomed to presenting himself in public. But in this case, I am against it.
We both know this, Rusty. Two groups of persons make good witnesses, those who are essentially truthful and skilled liars. You are an essentially truthful person and would ordinarily make a fine witness in your own behalf. Certainly you have years of training in how to communicate with a jury. I have no doubt that if you were to testify to everything you knew, you would do so convincingly and that you would be acquitted. Deservingly, I might add. He looks at me briefly, a quick but penetrating expression. I'm not positive whether that is a vote of confidence in my innocence or another comment on the poor quality of the state's case, but I sense the former, and I find myself pleasantly surprised. With Stern, of course, it is possible that he had offered that now only to sweeten this pill.
However, he says, I am convinced, after observing you for several months now, that you will not testify to everything you know. Some matters remain your secret. Certainly at this juncture I do not wish to pry. I mean that sincerely. With some clients, persuasion is called for. With others, you would just as well not know. In a few cases, it is best to leave things undisturbed. That is my sense here. I am confident that the choice you have made is a deliberate one and well considered. But be that as it may, when one comes to the witness stand determined to tell less than the truth, he is like a three-legged animal in the wild. You are not a skillful liar. And if Nico blunders into this area of sensitivity, whatever it is, things will go very badly for you. A pause. A silence, just a bit longer than need be, passes between us. We must assess the case as it is, Stern says. We have not had a bad day yet for the defense. Well, perhaps one, but there is not a piece of evidence that stands untarnished. And this afternoon we have dealt a blow from which the state is not likely to recover. It is my best professional judgment that you should not testify. Whatever your chances, and I admit that I think after today they are quite good, whatever your chances, they are best this way. Having said all of that, let me remind you that it is your decision. I am your attorney, and I will present your testimony, if you choose to give it, with confidence and conviction, no matter what you choose to say. And certainly no choices need be made tonight. But I wanted to let you begin your period of final reflection with my own views in mind. He is gone a few moments later, his tie knotted and his perfect jacket removed from its hanger behind the door. I remain in his office, made somber by his remarks. This is the closest Stern and I have come to a heart-to-heart. His candor, after so many months of suppression, is disturbing, no matter how kindly or elegantly phrased. I wander down the hallway with the thought in mind to have another glass of champagne. Kemp's light is still on. He is at work in his small office. Over one of the filing cabinets, merely pasted to the wall, is a poster. Dropped out against a vibrant red background is a young man in a spangled jacket. He is playing a guitar, and the photo has caught him in motion so that his hair stands on end like a dandelion gone to seed. The word Galactics crosses from corner to corner in white caps. I'm sure that few people who walk in
recognize the Jamie Kemp of a decade ago. "I got you in some hot water with the boss," I say. "I apologize." "Shit, that's my own fault," he points to a chair. "He's the most disciplined human being I know. And one hell of a lawyer."
"Isn't he? Have you ever seen anything like what went on today?"
"Never," I tell him. "Never in 12 years.
How long have you guys had that stuff?"
"Sandy noticed the line in the autopsy Sunday night. We got the records from the gynecologist yesterday.
You want to hear something? Stern thinks it was just a mistake. He feels Kumagai does everything half-ass. When he got the chemist's results, he went on from there and forgot about the autopsy."
"I don't buy that."
"No?
Well, what do you think?"
"I think you were set up."
"Well," I say after an instant, "I've thought that a lot longer than you."
"I believed it," says Kemp, "most of the time."
I'm sure he is thinking about the phone records again, but he does not mention them.
"Do you know who did it?"
I take a moment with that. "Why wouldn't I tell my lawyers?"
"What do you think about Molto?"
"Maybe," I say. "Probably."
"What does he get out of it?
Keeps you from looking into that file? What do you call it, the B file?" "The B file," I repeat.
"Except he can't believe you're not going to mention it if he puts it to you."
"Yeah, but look at the position I'm in. Would you rather be accused by the chief deputy PA or some wild man you're trying to nail for murder? Besides, he wouldn't know how far along we were. He'd just want to keep anybody from going forward."
"That's pretty amazing, don't you think? Bizarre?"
"That's probably one reason I don't quite believe it."
"What are the others?"
I shake my head. "I'll have a better idea tonight."
"What's tonight?"
I shake my head again. "For Lapranzer's sake, I cannot take any chances. This will be between only him and me."
"Is this do-it-yourself night?"
"That it is," I say. "You better be careful. Don't start doing Della Guardia any favors." "Don't worry," I say. "I know what I'm doing." I stand up and consider my last statement, one of the most far-fetched I have recently made. I bid Kemp good night and go back down the hallway to look for the champagne. Chapter 34. Like Santa Claus or the demons that come out in the woods, Lapranzer arrives at my home after midnight. He seems lively and unusually good-humored as Barbara greets him at the door in her nightclothes. Awaiting Lip, I have felt not the slightest inclination to sleep. Instead, the events of the day have combined in such a fashion that for the first time in months I have a sensation which I recognize as something more than hope aborning. It is like the closed eyelids' trembling reception of new daylight. Somewhere inside there is faith reignited that I am going to be free. In that mellow luminescence I have passed the most pleasant time in weeks with my wife. Barbara and I have been drinking coffee together for hours, talking about the demise of painless Kumagai and Nathaniel's scheduled return on Friday, the prospect of a renewed life a balm upon us.
"Downtown they're seeing some wild things," Lapranzer tells both of us. "Right before I pulled out of the hall, I talked to a guy who had just heard from Glendenning. They say DeLay's talking about dismissing the case, and Tommy is kicking and screaming and trying to think up a new thing. Could that be right?"
"Could be," I say. At the mention of Nico dismissing, Barbara has taken hold of my arm.
"What the hell happened in that courtroom today?" Lip asks.
I start to tell him the story of Kumagai's cross-examination, but he has already heard it.
"I know that," he says. "I mean, how is it possible? I told you that little jerk said the guy was shooting blanks. I don't care how many times he denied it." "One thing, Ted Kumagai's history. There ain't a soul in the hall not saying he'll be suspended by next week."
As Kemp predicted. By now, I find my feelings of sympathy pinched. Barbara sees us out the door.
"Be careful," she says.
Lapranzer and I sit a moment in the driveway in the unmarked Aries. I perked another pot of coffee, this one with caffeine, when Lip arrived, and Barbara has given him a second cup for the road. He is sipping on it as we sit there. "So, where are we going?" I ask.
"I want you to guess," he says.
It is, of course, a little late to go visiting, but I learned this approach from the coppers a long time ago. If you've got to find someone, the best time to be looking is in the dead of the night, when almost everybody's at home.
"Give me your shot on Leon," Lip says. "You know, tell me about him."
"I have no idea. He's got some kind of job that he wants to keep, that was clear from the letter. So he has to make a good buck. But he lives on the edge. I don't know. Maybe he owns a restaurant or a bar with some straight partners. He could be anything semi-respectable. He runs a theater company. How's that? Am I close?"
"You'd never get close. Is he white?"
"Probably. Pretty well off, whatever he is."
"Wrong," says LaPranzer.
"No shit?" LaPranzer is laughing.
"All right," I say. 20 questions is over. What's the scoop?" "Feature this," says LaPranzer. "He's a night saint."
"Come on.
Sheet as long as my arm. Gang crimes has got all kinds of intelligence on him. This guy's like a lieutenant now, whatever they call him, a deacon. Runs things on 2 floors in the projects. He's been up there for years. Apparently, he figured that all his hard-ass pals wouldn't think much of him if they found out he was running out to the public forest to suck white boys' cocks. That's his thing. Moduleski's got a snitch, gay as a jaybird, teaches high school, who gave him all kinds of information on this Jamoke. Seems like he and Leon went sneaking around together for years. This guy was Leon's teacher. Eddie something. 9 out of 10, that's the fellow who's been writing letters."
"Son of a bitch. So where are we going? Grace Street?"
"Grace Street," says LaPranzer.
The words are still enough to settle a shiver near my heart and my spine. Lionel Keneally and I spent a few evenings in there. Early mornings, actually. 3 a.m., 4. The safest time for a white man.
"I give him a call," says LaPranzer. "He's an affluent type. Got a phone and everything." "In his own name, by the way. That P.I. Berman did a hell of a job. Anyway, I called about an hour ago. Said I was giving away newspaper subscriptions. He wasn't interested, but he said yeah when I asked if I was talking to Leon Wells."
"A night saint," I think, as we drive toward the city. "A night saint," I murmur out loud. I became familiar with Grace Street projects during my 4th year as deputy P.A., By then, I had joined Raymond Horgan's fair-haired coterie, and he selected me to lead a large-scale police grand jury investigation of the Night Saints. This assault on the city's largest street gang was announced by Raymond just in time to become the centerpiece of his first re-election campaign. For Raymond, it was an ideal issue. Negro gangsters were not popular with anybody in Kendall County, and success would permanently dispel his bleeding-heart image. The Saints investigation was my initial trip to the spotlight, the first time I worked with reporters at my side. It took almost 4 years of my life. By the time Raymond ran for re-election again, we had convicted 147 identified gang members. The press heralded Raymond Horgan's unprecedented triumph and never mentioned that more than 700 Saints remained on the street doing all the old things. The Saints' genesis would make some sociologist a reasonably good dissertation. Originally, they were the Outlaws of the Night, a small, not particularly well-disciplined street gang in the North End. Their leader was Melvin White. Melvin was a fine-looking American, with one sightless eye, milky and wandering, and for balance, perhaps, a dangling turquoise earring 3 inches long in the opposite ear. His hair tended toward the straight and was worn in Gorgon fashion, resembling, if anything, an unkempt Rastafarian tangle. Melvin was a thief. He stole hubcaps, guns, mail, the change from vending machines, and all manner of motorized vehicles. One night, Melvin and 3 of his pals killed an Arab gas station owner, who drew on them while they were emptying his register. They pled to involuntary manslaughter, and Melvin, who up until then had only visited state youth camp, went to Rudyard, where he and his 3 buddies got to meet men to admire. Melvin emerged 4 years later in a caftan and phylacteries and announced that he was now Chief Harukan, leader of the Order of Nighttime Saints and Demons. 20 other bloods dressed just like him settled in the same part of town, and within the next 12 months they all began, as they put it, involving themselves in the community. Melvin gathered his followers to him in a deserted apartment building he called his ashram. He preached from a loudspeaker on weekends and evenings, and during the day he taught those inclined how to steal. Initially it was mail. The saints had people in the post office. Many, in fact. They stole not only checks and the tickets to events, but account information, so that they could pass forgeries at any bank. Harukan had what, for lack of anything else, has to be called the vision to recognize the principles of capitalist enterprise, and his profits were reinvested, usually in decimated real estate in the North End purchased at county scavenger sales. Eventually, entire blocks were saint-owned. The saints drove up and down in their big cars. They blasted their horns and played their radios. They hustled the daughters of the neighborhood and made hoodlums, willingly or not, of the sons. Harukan, in the meantime, emerged as a political figure. The saints gave away food on the weekends. As they became better established, Melvin led the saints into smack. Entire buildings became processing centers. Guys with chemistry degrees would cut the heroin with quinine and lactose while two dudes with M16s watched them. In a second area, six women, each one stark naked to prevent any body cavity smuggling, made up dime bags, closing them off with seal-a-meals. Out on the streets, in Saintland, high-grade heroin was sold from stands. There were drive-up windows in garages, to which white kids from the suburbs could come down to score. And on weekends, the traffic was so bad that some mogul in caftan and shades would be down there with a whistle telling people where to go. Once or twice, the newspapers tried to write about what was going on, but the coppers didn't like it. There were policemen on the take, something the department has traditionally preferred to ignore, and the cops who weren't taking were just scared. The saints killed. They shot, they garroted, they stabbed. They murdered, of course, in dope squabbles, but they also killed because of minor differences of opinion, because someone insulted the upholstery in somebody's mobile, or because of an innocent brushing of shoulders on the street. They ran 6 square blocks of this city, their own little hey-dude fascist arena, a quarter of their terrain occupied by the Grace Street projects. I have heard it said on many occasions that these projects were drawn from the same architectural plans as the student dormitories at Stanford. Suffice it to say, there is no resemblance now. The small balconies at the rear of each apartment have been curtained off with chicken wire to end the rain of suicides, infants, drunks, and persons pushed, who, over the first 5 years, became a sauce upon the pavement below. Most of the sliding glass doors to the balconies have been replaced with plywood sheets, and from the balconies themselves a wide variety of objects hang, including laundry, garbage cans, gang banners, old tires, car parts, or, in winter, anything that profits by being kept out of the heat. No sociologist can portray how far the life in these 3 concrete towers is from the existence most of us know. "It is not Sunday school," was Lionel Keneally's favorite phrase. And he was right. It was not. But it was more than cheap irony or even rabid racism could comprehend. This was a war zone, akin to what was described by the guys I knew who came back from Nam. It was a land where there was no future, a place where there was little real sense of cause and effect. Blood and fury, hot and cold, those were terms that had some meaning. But you could not ask anybody to do anything that involved some purchase on what might happen next year, even next week. At times when I listened to my witnesses describe the daily events of project life, in the disconnected way most of them had of doing that, I would wonder if they were hallucinating. Morgan Hobberly, my star, a reformed saint who truly got religion, told me that one morning he rolled out of bed to the sound of gunfire outside his door. When he investigated, he found himself caught between 2 bloods trying to zap each other with carbines. I asked Morgan what he did. Back to sleep, babe. Not my thing. Pulled my pill over my head. In truth, my 4 years of investigation succeeded only because of Morgan Hobberley. The whole incursion into gang life, which Stern has trumpeted before my jury on a dozen occasions, came down to one piece of luck, finding Morgan. An organization like Harukan's did not have the kind of membership who could not be bought. Dozens of them were informants for the police or the federal agencies. But Melvin was smart enough to have a few of them out there doing counterintelligence work. We were never sure what was right, since we got, through our sources, two or three different stories at any one time. But Morgan Hobberley was the real thing. He was on the inside, not particularly because he wanted to be, but because the Saints enjoyed having him around. Everybody knows a Morgan Hobberley. He was born cool, given a grace the way some people are born to music or horses or high jumping. His clothes just hung on him right. His movements were lithe. He was not so much beautiful as composed, not so much handsome as present. Aloof was not the right word as much as magical. There was a vibration he stirred in me that somehow reminded me of my feelings for Nat. And because some moral voice that Morgan took for divine told him one morning that Harukan's ways were evil, Morgan secretly went to work for the state. We put a body recorder on him, and he sat in the meetings of chieftains. He gave us the numbers of phones we connected to pen registers, and eventually tapped. In the 70 days that Morgan Hobberley helped us, we gathered virtually all the evidence for trials that lasted another 2 years. He did not make it, of course. The good, they say, never do. It was Keneally who told me they'd found Morgan. They had a call from the Public Forest District Command, he said, and it didn't sound encouraging. When I arrived, there was already that funny scatter of cops and paramedics and reporters familiar to a murder scene. Nobody wants to talk to anybody else. Nobody wants to be near the body. People were all over, shot out in different places like spores. I couldn't figure where he was. Lionel was there already, with his hands dug deep into his windbreaker. He gave me that low look of his, the varlet's eyes. "We fucked up bad," he was saying. And then his eyes drifted back enough for me to guess the general direction. He had died of drowning. So Coroner Russell later determined. I would not let Kumagai near the body. He had died of drowning, the coroner found, in the waste pool of a public outhouse. That was where he was, upside down, with his head and his two broken shoulders pushed through the wooden seat. Rigor mortis had set in, so that his legs were spread at a kind of scarecrow angle, and his plain twill work pants and raveled nylon socks and worn Oxfords created an atmosphere of unbearably humble address. His skin, the band of flesh visible where the pants and socks didn't meet, was purple, a royal shade. I stood in that tiny wooden shack, where a fly or two still buzzed even though it was now November, where the air was rank even without the summer heat, and contemplated Morgan Hobberley's strange humor, and the ether on which I always thought that he could float. I believed less then in angels and ghosts because I had thought, surely, that this was one man who, as he made his way through the world, could not be touched. Lepranzer is looking cold, not unemotional or distant, but actually cold, although the nighttime temperature in August is still verging on the 70s. His shoulders are hunched close, and his windbreaker is zipped tight. I know him well enough to recognize this is a sign of discomfort, if not fright. On this turf, I am probably more experienced. "How are you doing, Charlie Chan?" I ask him as we head up the concrete staircase. "Me no likey this one, boss," he says. "Uh-uh, no fucky way." In the projects, a staircase is a building's main thoroughfare. The elevators are seldom operable, and when they are, nobody will get on them anyhow, since there is no mercy for him who finds himself between floors with a carload of saints. Instead, all commerce is transacted in this stairwell. Dope is sold here, wine is drunk here, love is made. It is near 3 a.m., and still this vertical Ganges is not completely deserted. Near floor 4, two young men are drinking something in a bag and trying to romance a young woman whose head is lolled back against the cinder blocks. "How you doing, brother?" they say to a black man who happens to be climbing up ahead of us. To Lip and me, they say nothing, but their looks are insolent and cold, and Lip, without missing a step, flips out his tin as we are going past. He does not want to be mistaken for an ordinary white man. At the top of the stairway, the 8th floor, Lip holds a finger to his lips and quietly pulls the steel fire door back. I follow him into the corridor, a typical project hallway. Brightly lit to discourage intruders, trash along the sides in isolated pieces, an uncut smell of human use. About halfway down the wall, the sheetrock has been smashed out in a shape which, for all the world, resembles someone's head. In a hallway like this, one of Lionel Keneally's guys shot Melvin White the night after we returned the first round of indictments. I was outside to supervise the arrests, but it was about 20 minutes after we all heard the gunfire before the coppers would let me go in. By then the ambulance had arrived, and I went up with the paramedics. Along with the surgeons, they eventually saved Melvin's life, making way for his return to Rudyard. When I saw him, however, Harukan's chances did not seem good. They had laid him out in the middle of the hallway next to his automatic rifle. He was making a sound too labored, too desperate to be called groaning, and his stomach and his arms, which lay upon it, were painted with blood. Between his hands, a little twisted purple piece of tissue protruded. And above him stood Stapleton Hobberley, Morgan's brother, who had begun snitching for us after Morgan was killed. Stapleton had his penis in his hands. He was urinating in Melvin White's face while a number of coppers lounged against the walls and watched. "And what the fuck am I supposed to say if this guy dies of drowning?" one of the paramedics asked me. Now Lip is rapping on the door. "Open up, Leon. Wake up. It's the police. Come on, man, we just want to talk." We wait. The building, in a way that is almost beyond the threshold of detection, seems more silent now. Lip raps again with the flat of his palm. There is no kicking this door in. They are all reinforced steel. Lepranzer shakes his head, and at that moment the door suddenly, silently, swings open. It is very slow. Inside, the room is totally black, no sign of light. Somehow, an extraordinary adrenal rush has begun. If I were to pick out the details that key this response, I could only identify the little metal click. But even before that, there is an instantaneous perception of alarm. Danger is palpable in the air, as if the threat of harm were an odor, a stirring like wind. When I hear the sound of the gun being readied, I realize that we are perfect targets, standing backlit in the bright hallway. Yet clear as the thought is, I have no impulse to move. Lepranzer, though, is going. Somewhere along he has said, "Motherfucker," and as he is on the way down, he slides in my direction and cuts my leg out from under me. I land painfully on an elbow and roll away. We both end up lying on our bellies on the floor, staring at one another from either side of the door. Lepranzer has his pistol gripped with both hands. Lip closes his eyes and yells at top volume, "Leon, I am the police. This man is the police. And if your piece is not out here in 10 seconds, I'm calling this in. They are blasting your ass away before you can say shit. Now I'm going to start counting." Lip gets to his knees and presses his back to the wall. He motions with his chin for me to do the same thing. "One," he yells. "Man," we hear, "if you're the police, how am I going to know it? Huh? How am I going to know it?" Out of his windbreaker, Lip draws his creds, the star and his picture ID. He inches toward the doorway, then allows only his hand to cross its plane as he pitches them in. "Two," Lip yells. He is backing away. He points up at the lit exit sign. We are going to have to run for it soon. "Three. Man, I'm putting on the lights now, okay? Okay? But I'm keeping my peace. 4. Okay, okay, okay." The gun scutters over the tiles and lands against the molding of the hallway with a thump. A heavy black item. Until it stopped, I thought it was a rat.
Light from the apartment angles out of the threshold. "Out here, Leon," Lip yells. "Down on your knees."
"Oh, man."
"Down."
"Shit."
He comes knee-walking right out the doorway, his arms extended before him. He is quick and comical now. The cops, man. Always so serious.
Lip pats him down, then he nods, and the three of us get to our feet.
Lip snatches his creds back. Leon has a black sleeveless t-shirt and a red headband. On the bottom, he is wearing only his jockey shorts. Apparently, we roused him. A smooth-skinned, powerfully built man.
"I'm Detective LaPranzer, Special Command. I'd like to come in and talk."
"Now, who's he, man?"
"He's my goddamn friend."
Lip, who still has his gun in his hand, pushes Leon.
"Now get back inside."
Leon goes first. Lip covers the doorway, with his gun held by his face. He flashes from post to post, staring inside. Then he goes in to search. After a moment, he emerges and motions me in. He holsters his pistol again at his back under the coat.
"Man, would we have been a headline," I say to him, my first words since this started. "If he was shooting, you might have saved my life."
Lip makes a face meant to disparage me.
"If he was shooting, you were dead by the time I knocked you down."
Inside, Leon is waiting for us. His apartment is a galley kitchen and a couple of rooms. There is no sound of anyone else, but he is seated on a mattress on the floor of the living room. He has put on his pants. A plastic alarm clock and an ashtray are by the bed at his feet.
"We want to ask you a couple of questions," Lip says. "If you're straight, we're out of your face in 5 minutes."
"Hey, man, you come in here 3 o'clock in the morning? Come on, man, give me a break. Call Charlie Davis, man. He's my attorney, man. Talk to him, Jack, because I'm tired and I'm going to sleep."
He leans back against the wall and closes his eyes.
"You don't need an attorney, Leon."
Leon, still with his eyes closed, laughs. He's heard that one before.
"You got immunity," LaPranzer tells him. "This guy's a PA, aren't you?"
Leon opens his eyes in time to see me nod.
"See? Now you have immunity."
772, says Leon. 5868. That's his number, man. Charlie Davis.
"Leon," says Lip, "about 8-9 years ago, you dropped $1,500 on a deputy PA to make some problems you had go away. You know what I'm talking about?"
"No chance, man, okay? I mean, you come busting into my home, 3 o'clock in the morning, man, asking me shit like that. Am I a fool, man, huh? Am I a fucking fool? I'm going to be talking to some fucking white-ass policeman about shit like that. Come on, man. Go home. Let me sleep."
He closes his eyes again. Lip makes a sound. For some reason, I get the idea that he is going back to his gun, and I have an impulse to stop him. But instead, he walks slowly over to Leon. He crouches, right at the head of his bed. Leon has watched him approach, but he closes his eyes once LaPranzer has reached his level. Lip takes his index finger and jabs Leon a couple of times in the forearm. Then Lip points at me.
"See that guy? That guy's Rusty Savage."
Leon opens his eyes. Captain Saint Killer, right in his living room.
"Bullshit," says Leon.
"Show him your card," says LaPranzer.
I am hardly prepared for this, and I have to empty the pockets of my sport coat. In the process, I discover that my coat is gray across its entire front with the hallway's soil. I have brought along the documents Lip obtained months ago from Leon's court file, my appointment diary, my wallet. In there, I find one dog-eared card. I give it to LaPranzer, who hands it to Leon.
"Rusty Savage," says LaPranzer again.
"So?"
asks Leon.
"Leon," says Lip, "how many of your blood brothers do you think have been on his pad, huh? 25? 35? How many saints do you think he's paid to snitch? You go back to sleep, Leon, and Rusty Savage is going to get on the phone tomorrow morning. He's going to tell every one of them how you go out to the forest to suck off white boys. He's going to give them who and when and where.
He's going to tell them how they can find out all about this stone faggot deacon they got, name of Leon Wells. Okay? You think this is bullshit? This is not bullshit, my man. This is the guy who let Stapleton Hobberly take a piss in Harukan's face. Have you heard that story, huh? Now all we want is 5 minutes of your time. You tell us the absolute truth, and we're going to leave you alone. We got to know a couple of things. That's all.
Leon has not moved much, but his eyes are wide open as he listens to Lapranzer. There is no more play in his expression. Yeah, man. Next week you need something else. You'll be busting in the door at 3 o'clock in the morning pulling this shit again.
We'll tell you right now if we're ever going to need anything else. Just as soon as you answer our questions.
What we'll need is for Leon to come down to court to testify if he nails Molto. But Lip knows the ropes. You don't tell them that for a while.
Now don't bullshit me, Leon. Here's my first question. Did you or did you not pay $1,500 to make that case go away?
Leon makes a sound. He sits up straight.
That fucking Eddie, he says. You already know, man, right? So why you bothered me?
Leon, says Lip quietly, you heard my question.
Yeah, man, I paid $1,500.
My heartbeat has become very solid now. Thump, thump. I expect to see my pocket jumping when I look down at my shirt. I speak for the first time. Did the woman have anything to do with it? Carolyn, the probation officer?
Leon laughs. Yeah, man. You might say that.
What?
Come on, man, he says. Don't shit me. That bitch set the whole thing up, man. You know that. She tell me I don't have to be moping round. She know how to take care of everything. Real smooth. Real smooth. Man, I bet she did it 100 times. Tell me where to go. How to bring the bread, man. Very cold, lady. You hear me?
I do. I crouch down now like Lapranzer. And was she there when you made the drop?
Right there. Sitting right there. Very cool. You know, man. How you do? Sit right there. Then the dude start talking.
He was behind you?
You got it. She be telling me when I come in. Don't turn round. Just do what the man say.
And he told you to put it in his desk?
No, man. The desk where I was. He say, just leave it in the top drawer.
That's what I mean. It was the PA's desk, right?
Yeah, that desk.
And you paid him, right? Asks Lapranzer. The PA?
Leon looks at him with irritation.
No, man, I ain't gonna be paying no little toad PA. Am I a fool? He gonna take my bread, man, and be saying, oh, no, can't do it. Just got the word from downtown. I heard enough of that shit.
Lapranzer looks over at me. He has not gotten it yet. But I have. Just now. Finally.
God, am I dense. Dense. So who was it? Asks Lip.
Leon mugs. He does not like to tell a policeman anything he does not already know. I say it for him. The judge, Lip. Leon paid the judge. Right?
Leon nods. Black dude. Was him too, man. Behind me. I could tell the voice when I heard him in court.
Leon snaps his fingers trying to get the name. But there's not any need for him to bother. It's right on the order of dismissal. I take it out of my pocket to check. There's no missing that signature. I've seen it dozens of times in the last 2 months. It's as distinctive as everything else Laren does.
So what is it?
Lip asks. It is nearly 5 now, and we are sitting in Wally's, an all-night joint by the river. They used to be famous for donut holes before the national chains got hold of that idea, too.
Laren's porking her and taking the money to keep her in style?
Lip is still wired. On the way here, he stopped at some hole in the wall, a blind pig he knew about, and came out with a half pint of peach brandy, of all things. He drank it down like a Coke. He still had not shaken off our initial encounter at the doorway.
God, he said to me, sometimes I hate being a cop.
Now I shake my head at his questions. I don't know. The only thing I have figured out for certain in the last hour is that this is what Keneally didn't want to tell me when I saw him last week, that Laren was taking. That's what pissed off the coppers back then. The judge was doing it, too.
What about Molto? Asks Lip. You figure he was in?
I figure he was out. I don't see Laren Little in any triangles. Nico said Molto always looked up to Carolyn. She probably asked him to dismiss cases, and he just obliged. I'm sure he had the hots for her like everyone else. All very Catholic and suppressed, of course. That would make sense, too. That's the fuel that's kept Molto's engine running at high speed. Unresolved passion. We talk it over like this for most of an hour. Eventually it gets late enough to have breakfast, and we both order eggs. The sun is coming up now over the river, that spectacular profusion of rose-colored light. I suddenly think of something and laugh. I laugh too hard, with an embarrassing lack of control, a bout of juvenile hilarity. My thought is ridiculous, not really funny at all, but it has been a long and very odd day.
What? Lip asks.
All these years I've known you, and it never really dawned on me.
What's that?
I start laughing again. It's a moment before I can speak. I never realized. You carry a gun. Chapter 35. Barbara rolls over as I approach the side of the bed in my pajamas.
Are you getting up now?
She squints toward the clock. It is 6:30.
It's early, isn't it?
I'm going to bed, I tell her. She starts and rolls to her elbow, but I wave that it is not worth talking about. I do not think I will sleep, but I do. I dream of my father in jail. Barbara waits until the last minute to wake me, and we have to race. The traffic on the bridge is thick, and court is already in session when we arrive. Kemp and the two prosecutors are before the judge. Nico is talking. He looks dour and drawn, and his manner in addressing the judge can only be described as agitated. I sit down next to Stern. Barbara had called to tell him we would be late, but she diplomatically omitted any mention of why. I spend the first moments of my whispered conference with Sandy assuring him that we are both in good health. Then he explains what is happening.
The prosecution has entered their hour of desperation. I will tell you about it when the judge breaks. They want Molto to testify.
I thought that was what Nico was talking about. When he is done exhorting the judge, Laren looks down and says simply, No.
Your Honor, Mr. de la Guardia, we went over this carefully the first day of the trial. You may not call Mr. Molto.
Judge, we had no idea. Mr. de la Guardia, if I were inclined to allow Mr. Molto to testify, then I ought to declare a mistrial right now. Because if this case ever got to the Court of Appeals, ever, I say hypothetically, but if it ever got there, they would turn it around and send it right back. Mr. Stern asked the first day of trial about Mr. Molto's testimony, and you said no how and no way, and that's how it stands.
Judge, you said that we would be entitled to some leeway if the defense proceeded with this frame-up theory. You said that.
And I allowed you to stand before the jury and make one entirely improper statement in their presence. Do you recall what occurred while Mr. Horgan was on the witness stand? But I should have had more faith in Mr. Stern's professional acumen than to suppose he would venture down that road without reason. I didn't know then, Mr. de la Guardia, that the state's chief piece of evidence was going to disappear after last being seen with Mr. Molto. I didn't know that Mr. Molto and the chief pathologist were going to manufacture evidence or testimony. And I tell you, sir, that is a reasonable interpretation of the events of yesterday. I'm still considering the question of what happens with Mr. Molto. But one thing that isn't going to happen is that he gets up on the witness stand and makes matters worse. Now, what's the other thing you wanted to bring up?
Nico is silent, his head bowed for a second. When he straightens up, he takes an instant to adjust his jacket.
Judge, we're going to call a new witness.
Who is that?
Dr. Miles Robinson, Mr. Savage's psychiatrist. He was on our witness list. We omitted him from the order of proof, but I informed Mr. Stern about the change last night.
Beside Stern, I have tensed. He has his hand on my arm to prevent a more precipitous reaction.
"What the hell is this?" I whisper.
"I was going to discuss this with you this morning," says Stern quietly. "I have spoken with the doctor. I will give you my estimate of what the prosecutors are up to in a moment."
"And what's the problem?" asks Laren. "Mr. Stern objects to calling the witness without notice?"
Stern stands. "No, Your Honor, I object to the witness's testimony, but not on that basis."
"State your objection, Mr. Stern."
"Your Honor, we object on two grounds. Whatever the enlightened view may be of psychotherapy, many persons continue to regard it as a stigma. This testimony, therefore, risks serious prejudice to Mr. Savage. More important, I expect that Mr. Molto, who, as I understand it, will be questioning Dr. Robinson, will elicit material that would violate the physician-patient privilege."
"I see," Laren says again. "Are you moving to suppress?"
Stern looks down at me. Something is on his mind. He leans in my direction, then seems to think better of it.
"Your Honor, my remarks are likely to give offense, for which I apologize. But I believe they are appropriate and necessary to articulating my client's interest. Judge Little, I question the prosecutor's motives in offering this proof. I perceive no factual basis for overcoming the testimonial privilege that prevents a physician, certainly a psychotherapist, from testifying about his treatment-oriented conversations with a patient. I believe that this testimony is offered knowing that the defense must move to suppress it and that the court must allow that motion. When that occurs, the prosecutors will have someone else to blame when the case reaches the end for which we all now know it is destined."
Nico becomes fiery. He pounds on the podium, incensed by Stern's suggestion that he and Molto are out to trick-bag the judge.
"I deny that," he says. "I deny that. I think that is an outrage."
He does another of his stomping routines, revolving away, and ends up at the prosecutor's table, staring fiercely at Stern as he drinks a cup of water. Laren is quiet for a long time. When he speaks, he makes no comment on what Stern has suggested.
"Mr. Delaguardio, on what basis will you seek to overcome the privilege?"
Nico and Molto confer.
"Your Honor, we expect the evidence to show that Mr. Savage saw Dr. Robinson on only a few occasions. As a result, we believe that Mr. Savage's statements were not for the purpose of seeking treatment and are outside the privilege."
I have heard all I can handle. Aloud, if under my breath, I remark, "What bullshit." Perhaps the judge hears me. Certainly he looks in my direction.
"Listen here," says Laren. "This case hasn't gone very well for the state. Any jackass would know that. Nobody here is a jackass. But if you think, Mr. DeLaguardia, that I'm going to let you elicit privileged testimony so that you can try to pull a rabbit out of a hat, you better have another think or two. I can't and I won't allow that. Now, sir, I'm not going to suppress this testimony. I don't have any comments on Mr. Stern's observations. I don't know whether he's right. I will only say that it is appropriate to adjudicate a claim of privilege on a question-by-question basis. If you want to put this witness on in the jury's presence, be my guest. But I'll tell you right now that you're on the edge as it is. The conduct of one of the prosecutors has been deplorable. And if he starts attempting to elicit privilege material in the jury's presence, then you're at your peril. Have you conferred with Dr. Robinson so that you know the permissible areas of inquiry?"
"Dr. Robinson has refused to meet with us."
"Well, good for him," says Laren. "You do what you want, Mr. DeLaguardia, but you better have a lot you can get from this witness, because I can only imagine what this jury is thinking by now."
Nico asks for a moment to confer. He and Molto walk together to a corner of the courtroom. Tommy is vehement. He has a high color, and he swings his hands emphatically. I am not surprised when Nico announces that they intend to proceed. So the jury is brought back to the box, and Miles Robinson comes to the witness stand. He is in his mid-60s, trim, with white hair cropped very close. He is soft-spoken and exceedingly dignified. In another era, he would have been called an octoroon. He is fairer than I am, but he is black. I met him briefly many years ago when he was called as a witness in an insanity case, the nation's leading expert on memory loss. He's a full professor at the medical school at the U, co-chair of the psychiatry department. When I had my troubles, he seemed pretty clearly to be the best shrink I could think of.
"Do you know Rusty Sabich?"
Molto asks, as soon as Robinson has stated his name, his office address, and his profession. Dr. Robinson turns to the judge.
"Do I have to answer that, Your Honor?"
Laren leans over. He speaks kindly.
"Dr. Robinson, Mr. Stern over there," he points, "represents Mr. Sabich. Anything he does not think you ought to be obliged to answer, he will object to. Otherwise, you should answer the questions posed. Don't worry now. He's highly qualified."
"We've spoken," says Robinson.
"Very good, then," says the judge. "Reread the question, please," Laren tells the court reporter.
"Yes," says Robinson, when that has been done.
"How do you know him?"
"He was my patient."
"How many times did you see him?"
"I checked my records last night. 5 times.
"From when to when?"
"February to April of this year. April 3rd was the last time."
"April 3rd?
Asks Molto. He faces the jury, who refuse to look at him. He means, however, to call attention to the fact that my last session was 2 days after the murder.
"Yes, sir."
"Did Mr. Sabich ever discuss Carolyn Polhemus with you?"
The doctor-patient privilege protects conversations, not acts. Up until now, Molto has not asked Robinson to repeat anything I have said. With this question, however, Stern quietly comes to his feet.
"Objection," he says.
"Sustained," says the judge, distinctly. He has folded his arms over his chest, and he glares down at Molto. It is clear that he shares Sandy's perception of the motives here, and he has conceived of his own politic compromise. He will let Robinson take the stand, and then sustain objections to any questions of consequence.
"Your Honor, may I have the basis of that ruling?"
asks Molto. He looks up to the bench defiantly. Lord, how these men hate each other. By now, it would require an archaeological dig to get through the sedimentary layers of resentments built up over the years. Some of it has to have been Carolyn. Molto is too primitive not to have been jealous. Did he know, back in their days in the North Branch, about the other dimension to Laren's relations with her? I puzzled on that most of the night. Who knew what about whom back then? And what does Laren think Molto knows now? Tangled webs. Whatever else, it is clear that the dispute between these men by now has nothing to do with me.
"Mr. Molto, you know the basis of the ruling. It was discussed before the jury entered. You have established a physician-patient relationship. Any communications are privileged. And if you question another of my rulings in the jury's presence, sir, your examination will end. Proceed."
"Dr. Robinson, isn't it true that Mr. Sabich stopped seeing you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Your treatment of him ceased?"
"Yes, sir."
"Judge, I submit that these conversations are not privileged."
"You are in contempt, Mr. Molto. Proceed with your examination."
Molto looks over to Nico. Then he lets it all out. He considers his armaments and reaches for the nuclear bomb.
"Did Rusty Sabich ever tell you that he had killed Carolyn Polhemus?"
There is the abrupt sound of people gasping throughout the courtroom. But I realize now why Nico was pounding on the podium. This is the question they brought Robinson here to answer. Nothing marginal, like whether I used to sleep with her. They are taking one last blind shot. The judge, however, is enraged.
"That is all," he screams. "That is all. I have had it with you, Mr. Molto. Had it. If the other questions are privileged, how isn't that one?"
I whisper to Stern. He says to me, "No." And I say to him, "Yes." And I actually take his elbow and push him to his feet. There is a rare tone of uncertainty as he speaks.
"Your Honor, we would not object to the question, as phrased, being answered."
Laren and Molto are both slow to respond. The judge, because of his wrath, and Molto in sheer confusion. They both finally comprehend at the same time. Molto says, "I move to withdraw the question." But the judge knows what is occurring.
"No, sir. You will not make an inquiry so prejudicial in the presence of the jury and then seek to withdraw it. So the record is clear. Mr. Stern, are you waiving the privilege?"
Stern clears his throat.
"Your Honor, the question does seek to elicit privileged communications, but in my view, the question, as framed, can be answered without invading the privilege."
"I see," says Laren.
"Well, I suppose that's right, if it goes one way. You ready to take your chances?"
Stern's eyes trail off toward me for an instant, but he responds clearly, "Yes, Your Honor."
"Well, let's listen to the answer, then. We'll know where we stand. Ms. Court Reporter, would you please read back Mr. Molto's last question?"